Today we'll be talking about the OG Caleb from the Old Testament, where my brother gets his name. But this is still going to be about legacy, which is very much what this was about. Just to give you a little backstory, in case you don't know, Caleb was one of the children of Israel that came out of Egypt during the Exodus. And during that time, Yahweh came and maybe some scholars say, reintroduced himself to Israel after hundreds of years of them being in captivity and being really under the thumb of the gods and the people of Egypt. And he came in and he brought these great plagues and showed himself as a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire to lead them, to show that his presence was with them. He parted the Red Sea. He provided them with manna from heaven. He also provided them with quail because they complained about the manna after a little while, and gave them water from a rock. And then finally, they got to see God's very presence come down and torch the top of Mount Sinai, where he gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. They saw incredible things that proved to them that Yahweh was the God above every other God, more powerful than the gods of Egypt, more powerful than Pharaoh, more powerful than the elements that they saw around them. He ruled and reigned it all, and he proved it to them time and time again. So finally, after this season of travel, here they were right on the border of the promised land. This was what God promised Abraham when he met him and called him out. This was the place that they were to inherit. And so as they arrived, the Lord told Moses to gather some men and have them go in and check out the land. And I'm going to read quite a bit here. They're not going to put it up on the screen because it is a lot. I'm also almost reading a whole chapter because the Bible tells the story really well. I don't feel the need to paraphrase it. So here we go. So as the Lord commanded, Moses sent for 12 men, one from each of the tribes of Israel, and they were all leaders among the Israelites. Not just anybody, not just guys that were good at spying and sneaking. Specifically, he picked leaders from every tribe. And so Moses sent these 12 men to check out Canaan. Go up through the Negev desert, go on into the central hill country. See what the land is like. See whether the people who live there are strong or weak. See whether they are few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Do the towns have high walls around them or not? How's the soil? Is the land rich or is it poor? Are there trees in it or not? Do your best to bring back some fruit from the land, as it was the season for the first ripe grapes. And so they went up to check out the land, wandered around, saw the towns and villages and different things. When they came to the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch that had a single bunch of grapes on it. And this was so laden with grapes and so heavy that it took two men to carry it between them on a pole. And they also carried away some pomegranates and some figs to show the people what the land could produce. And after 40 days, the men returned to Moses from checking out the land. Now, a little thing about that moment of them carrying the fruit and produce of the land out. There are rabbinical teachings called a midrash that are not biblical, but they take and they expound upon biblical content to give us some more context for what's going on. They've been passed down for hundreds of years. And there's one particular one concerning Caleb in this situation. And I like it because it gives us a really good window into what the man was like and what other people thought of him. So as they're going through and they're checking out all these places, Caleb and Joshua are getting excited. You know, they're all about this. They want to get out there and they want to conquer this land. They know the Lord's going to do it. And the other 10 are kind of like, I don't know, like this looks like it's going to be pretty difficult. And then they see the walls, they see all these things, and they just start freaking out. And so these 10 decide, hey, listen, I know Moses said that he wanted us to bring produce from the land and do all that, but we're not going to do that because we don't want to give any of our people a reason to hope and a reason to want to come out here. This is terrible. We don't want to fight and die here. So let's not do that. And so Caleb stands up, gets in front of them, and he pulls out his sword. And he says, okay, Moses asked us to do this. So if you won't do it, and take this stuff back to camp like he asked, either I'm going to kill every single one of you, or you're going to have to kill me. And he stood there, I'm sure, for just a minute while they were kind of like, oh, is he serious? Is he really? And so then the 10 decided, we don't want to mess with Caleb, so we'll go ahead and take this produce back to Moses and give it to him like he asked in the first place. That is one of the most legendary things I have ever heard of anybody doing. He was just built different. He just had that thing, and they were not going to mess with it. So begrudgingly, they decided, okay, we'll take this stuff back. We don't want to mess with Caleb. The other thing that they added is a little capper to that is apparently Joshua and Caleb didn't carry anything because they figured if you guys were the ones complaining and whining about this, you guys can carry it back. We're just going to walk back ourselves and you come along behind us and bring it. And nobody argued with them, of course. So the report they brought back starts at verse 26. The men came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole community of Israel. The people were at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. And these men reported to Moses and Aaron, all the people, the things that they had seen and heard. They showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses their report and they said, okay, well, we went into the land that you sent us. It really does have plenty of milk and honey. Here's some fruit from the land, but the people who live here are powerful. Their cities have high walls around them and are very large. We even saw members of the line of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev Desert. The Hittites and Jebusites and Amorites live in the central country. The Canaanites live near the Mediterranean Sea, and they also live along the Jordan River. So Caleb could kind of see where this was going. They were trying to play down the good stuff and just talk about all the bad. So then Caleb piped up, and he interrupted them. And of course, they shut up when he started speaking. And he said, no. We should go up and take the land. We can certainly do that. But the men who had gone up with him spoke, and they said, we cannot attack these people. They're stronger than we are. The men spread a bad report about the land among the Israelites, and they said, the land we checked out destroys those who live in it. All the people we saw are very big and tall. We saw the Nephilim there. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes compared to them, and that's also how we seem to them. The family line of Anak came from the Nephilim. And that's seems a little weird, but I don't want to ignore it just because it was weird. If you go to Genesis 6, you can kind of get some detail about that. It talks about the sons of God's coming and having relations with women and producing what was called the Nephilim. There's a lot that you could go into on that. Don't Google it because you'll get all kinds of weirdness from it. But come talk to Sheldon or me sometime and we can give you some details about that if you want it. But essentially what it comes down to is these supernatural beings, these God-like beings had come down and united with women and had produced what were called the Nephilim, which were these great heroes and huge people of renown and just powerful giant beings. And so they're telling them, they live there, we can't deal with that. So then the whole community began weeping aloud. They cried all night. Their voices rose in a great chorus of protests against Moses and Aaron. I just love the whining. As a father of four children, I love the whining in this passage. Why is the Lord bringing us here? If only we had died in Egypt. If only we could have died here in the wilderness, they complain. Why is the Lord taking us to this country only to have us die in battle? Our wives and our little ones will be carried off as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to return to Egypt? Then they plotted amongst themselves. Let's choose a new leader and go back to Egypt, where Yahweh had just proven himself more powerful than anything and everything that was there. Then Moses and Aaron fell face down on the ground before the whole community of Israel. And two of the men who had explored the land, Joshua, son of Nun, who would later succeed Moses as the leader of Israel, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, tore their clothing. And they said to all the people, the land we traveled through and explored is a wonderful land. And if the Lord is pleased with us, he will bring us safely into that land and he will give it to us. It is a rich land flowing with milk and honey. Do not rebel against the Lord and don't be afraid of these people of the land. They are only helpless prey to us. They have no protection, but the Lord, the God of gods, the one who destroyed and embarrassed the gods of Egypt. The Lord is with us. Don't be afraid of them. But the whole community then began to talk about stoning Joshua and Caleb to get them to shut up. And see, here's the thing. We look at this whole thing of the 10 spies and we get into the whole, oh, they were cowardly and all that. Their fears were very real. This was a civilization that had been hundreds of years in slavery. They knew nothing of war. They knew nothing of strategy. They had no business trying to conquer anything. Very correct. But what Joshua and Caleb and Moses and Aaron saw and knew that was different is that the Lord, that Yahweh, was with them. It didn't matter what the odds were. It didn't matter how fortified the cities were. God had called them out of slavery. God had called them to possess the land. And because God had done that, they were going to do it. It was as simple as that to them. But the people who loved their whining and complaining decided to believe the negative report of the 10 spies. And because of that, Yahweh declared this to Moses. Now, first he just said, I'm sick of these people. I'm going to wipe them out. I'm going to make you a great nation. We'll start over with you. Forget the line of Abraham. We're going to go with the line of Moses. And Moses comes along and says, no, we're not going to do that. I think that we need to stick to the original plan, like you said. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but that's basically how it goes. And so God says, all right, because you've interceded for them, I'm going to forgive them. However, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of those who saw my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me, and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised an oath to their ancestors. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit, I love that, has a different spirit, again, like I said, built different, and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it. So we're going to flash forward now 45 years. After 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the children of Israel come in, and they start to possess the land, and they take Jericho, and after a little hiccup, they take the next city and move on through. At this point, they've established themselves in the land. They have it. And this is about 5 years after that initial breach into the land. And then we see Caleb pop up again. And this is in Joshua 14. A delegation from the tribe of Judah, led by Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, came to Joshua. And he said this, remember what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, about you and me when we were at Kadesh Barnea? I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from there to explore the land of Canaan. And I returned to give an honest report. But my brothers who went with me frightened the people from entering the promised land. For my part, I wholeheartedly followed the Lord my God. So that day, Moses solemnly promised me, the land of Canaan on which you were just walking will be your grant of land, and that of your descendants forever, because you wholeheartedly followed the Lord my God. Now, as you can see, the Lord has kept me alive, and I'm well, just as he has promised, for all these 45 years since Moses made that promise. Even while Israel wandered in the wilderness. Today I am 85 years old, but I am as strong now as I was when Moses sent me on that journey. And I can still travel and fight as well as I could then. So give me the hill country that the Lord promised me. You will remember that as scouts, we found the descendants of Anak living there. That's the Nephilim. That's the big scary people. living there in great walled towns. But if the Lord is with me, I will drive them out of the land, just as the Lord said." So Joshua blessed Caleb and gave him Hebron as his portion of land. And it still belongs to the descendants of Caleb because he wholeheartedly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. So let's talk about Hebron a little bit. It's a place that you've probably heard of other times in the Bible. It's the place where David is initially crowned king over Judah before becoming king of all of Israel. It's actually the place where his son Absalom goes to try to depose him. It was a significant place, very much so. Caleb could have asked for any place. By this time, he had more than proven himself. He had earned his stripes in battle. He had the right to go off into the twilight of his life comfortably in a nice, safe place. Could have asked for a quiet vineyard or a sleepy stretch of land on the outskirts of Israel, but he didn't. I like to think of Caleb just pointing his 85-year-old bony finger at the distant hills and saying, "I want that." Hebron. It was the highest inhabited ground in all of Canaan. It was the hardest to conquer, so much so that in their conquest, they hadn't even gone near it. Fortified cities, thick walls, and giant scary people. But Caleb was not intimidated. He was drawn to it. And so we kind of have to ask the question, why? You see, for Caleb, Hebron meant something even more. It wasn't just random real estate. It wasn't about property. It wasn't even about the challenge of proving that he could still conquer that at 85 years old. Hebron was a promise. It was personal. Again, coming back to the rabbinic teachings about this. There's a story that's not in Scripture, but that's been passed down for a long time. And that is that when the 12 spies first set foot on the land of promise, and when Caleb kind of got the idea of where these other 10 were going with their thinking, he decided to break away from the group. And while they were calculating the odds and finding excuses to turn tail and run, Caleb took a detour. And he climbed the rocky ridges alone and made his way to a sacred place. You see, in Hebron, there was a cave. And in that cave were the bodies of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These were the patriarchs, the first men who God had promised, his forefathers, and his spiritual legacy. One of the things that we're told about Caleb is that his ancestry can be traced both from the Canaanite line and the line of Israel. So in entering this land, in entering this place, he kind of had claims on two fronts. He had the claim of his past and of his heritage of the people that lived there, but he also had the claim of the promise of the past and the heritage of what was to be. And he could have taken the easy way out. I mean, I imagine going in there and seeing all this fortified stuff, he probably had some distant relatives around still, and he could have just been like, "You know what? Forget these wandering people. I'm gonna hang out here. This is safe. There's all kinds of stuff here. Maybe these giant people can carry me around on their back. I'm going to stay here." But he didn't, because he believed the promise of God. And so he went and he sought out these tombs of the patriarchs. And there, in their shadow, Caleb knelt down and he pressed his face into the dust that was promised. And he prayed this: God of my fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, strengthen me. Keep me from the evil counsels of these men. And help me stand for you when no one else will. I'm not sure who Caleb was before that moment. Before this moment, Caleb's just another face in a crowd of 12. The only one who had any distinction was Joshua. And I don't know what drew Caleb to go find that cave. Maybe it was doubt that drew him there. Maybe he just wanted to see for himself if all these stories that he'd been told around a fireside from the time he was a small child, he wanted to see if they were really there. Whatever drew him there, that moment marked him forever. It shaped him. This was his God encounter. This was his moment of surrender. And he was never the same. You have to think that every single year of the 40 years that they were wandering in the wilderness, every time another of his friends or family was buried, every time he saw the children of Israel complaining and fighting against the plans that God had for them, I have to think that when his heart was tempted to quit, he went back to that moment, to that prayer, to that holy ground, and that it steadied him through those times. This is why 45 years later, when the Promised Land finally belonged to the Israelites, he didn't ask for comfort. He didn't ask for high, he asked for the high ground. He didn't ask for ease. He asked for the place that once brought him to his knees. Because he wasn't done trusting God. He wasn't done fighting giants. He wasn't done standing in the place that faith that had come before him once stood. Hebron was absolutely the hardest place. Again, they'd avoided it already. They hadn't gone there. It was the hardest place, but Caleb knew that it was the place where God got the most glory. And he wanted that ground. There's a little cap on the end of Caleb's story. After Joshua gives him that land and he goes and conquers it, because of course he did, he basically is going to take this one city. He's like, okay, whoever gets in that gate first, I'm gonna give you my daughter and this plot of land as a prize for doing that. So this guy did it, bold dude, went up, first one through the breach. Caleb's faithful to his promise, gives him his daughter and a large plot of land. But his daughter, after she gets this and she's married, she's looking around and she's like, there's no water here in this land. This isn't going to work. Because eventually we're going to have to fight somebody for water. We don't want to fight our fellow Israelites for this. We got to figure this out. So she goes to her husband and kind of, you know, elbows him in the ribs, I guess. And is like, hey, we don't have water here. You need to go talk to my father and get him to give us these upper and lower springs so that we can have water. Now, the Bible doesn't say this, but based on what happens after, I'm assuming he went, I am not asking your father for something. Like, there's no way that I'm going to go in there and tell him that what he gave me wasn't enough. You just be fine and don't worry about it. But this was Caleb's daughter. So what does she do? She saddles up a donkey. She rides out to meet her dad. And he sees her coming. And he looks at her and he goes, well, what's wrong? Clearly, he could see that she was concerned. And she says, listen, I need you to do me a special favor. You've given me all this land, and that's wonderful, but it's dry. So now also give me the springs of water above and below it. And Caleb, without hesitating, was like, all right, I'll do it. And he gave them to her. No inheritance squabbles, no issues that were going to come down the line. Took care of this right away. Now, why does that matter? For the people that were reading these writings at the time, and especially in the season where these things took place, women had zero authority over such matters. Once, essentially, a woman belonged to her father until she was married off, and then she belonged to her husband, no longer under the covering of her father. That's how it worked back then. I don't care if it offends your modern sensibilities, it's just the way culture was. Get over it. So she had no business at all moving out from under her husband's covering to ask her father for this. I mean, in some regards, this could have been a stoning offense even to a degree. It would have been seen as rebellion. But again, she was Caleb's daughter. I don't think people were going to mess with her. So why would she do that? She didn't shrink back. She didn't apologize. She went and asked for more. Why? Maybe because she'd watched her father walk in bold faith all her life. She saw him pray in the face of fear. She saw him ask for the hill country when he had no business asking for it. She had learned that this is what it means to walk in covenant with a faithful God. And she had that same different spirit as Caleb. This is how generational faith is built. This is how legacy works. Not in what we say, but in what we do. Not in what we accomplish, but how we trusted God through the process. We go all in for what God wants. We sell out completely, surrendering everything, including outcomes, to Him. And we stand when everyone else bows down. This is the kind of faith that your children will remember. This is the kind of faith that your grandkids will carry, because bold faith is contagious. Pastor Andrew sent me after first service a little quote from Reggie Joyner, and I think this applies to Caleb's daughter. He'd given her inheritance, he'd given her land, but he'd also passed on a legacy of faith. Reggie Joyner says this: an inheritance is something you leave for someone. A legacy is something you leave in someone. Caleb was built different because he'd had an encounter with God that altered the trajectory of his life. So much so that for generations, his descendants owned that land, held on to that legacy. Everybody go ahead and stand with me for a second. I don't know everyone's story here. For me, I've always said that I had no choice but to follow Jesus, and it wasn't because my dad made me. But I saw in my grandparents, and I heard about their parents, and I saw my parents and my aunts and uncles and great men and women of the church, lifers who just poured out their life, surrendered fully to the Holy Spirit. And I couldn't argue with that. No matter how rebellious I ever wanted to be, no matter what sin I struggled with, I always came back to, but I know this is true because I've seen it. I was handed a legacy that I want to hand to my kids. And so while I had a choice, I mean, I really didn't. What was I gonna do? Look at everything that I'd ever seen, everything I'd ever known, everything that had been proven to be true, and just look at it and be like, yeah, that's not worth it. I'm not doing it. I had no choice. I did, but I didn't. And so maybe some of you are saying, well, Pastor Nate, yeah, that's great, but I don't have that. I'm the first person that's ever been saved in my family. You know, I came from a bunch of hellions who didn't care anything about Jesus. But great. What do you think Abraham was? Even what Caleb had started with somebody. You can be that person that just determines from this moment on, we are going to serve the Lord. There will be a line here where I stand, and nothing will go past it. You can be the beginning of that legacy. For some of you, you've been handed a legacy and you want to pass it on. This is how you do it. It's not in browbeating. It's not in dragging kids to church, although I encourage you to bring them here. It's just living that life, believing that God will do what he said he's going to do. And it's not foolishness, but it is faith. So I want to ask you this question as we wrap. What are you asking God for? Now, let me be clear. I am not going to start touting word of faith garbage. And yes, garbage is the word I will use, and you can fight me about it if you want to. I won't tout that. God is not the magic genie in the sky that if we say the right things and do the right things and hold our mouth just right, that he's going to do what we want him to do. It's not how this works. If we are surrendered, if we are in his will, if we are following the path he's set us on, these are the prerequisites. What are you asking God for? Because I think we ask God for the easy things. We ask God for healing, or we ask God for provision, or we ask God for, you know, any number of things. Good things. But when it came to it for Caleb found the most difficult thing he could and said, I want that. Because he knew it was where God would get the most glory. We all have that thing. The thing that we know that God has called us to, the thing that we know without a shadow of a doubt that he has pointed us towards. And most of the time, we spend our time trying to get away from that thing. Fighting God, making him make us do it. You ever have your kids do that? When they make you make them do something? It's so fun. But what happens if we come like Caleb and be like, I know the challenge. I see the impossibility. But God is with me and he's asked me to do it. So he asked for the challenge. Are you settling in the valley? Or are your eyes drifting to that hill country? Are you passing on a spirit of fear that just lives in safety and security all the time? Or are you handing off a legacy of boldness and radical faith in the God who is more than proven himself? He's enough. If he's called us, if he has commissioned us, he is enough. And he will do it.